Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's August 12th. Currently 60 degrees here in Old Town Park City. You can repeat that in the Heber Valley. On the phone with an update on the weather, ABC meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, Wasatch back. It's time for your Tuesday forecast here. As we make your way throughout the day, we're looking at temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 80s in the Park City area. High temperatures will climb into the lower 90s in the Heber Valley again, with lots of sunshine expected across the region. As we go into your Wednesday, we're looking at that sunshine sticking around. Could see a couple of high clouds out there by the afternoon hours. Breezy conditions as well, so watch out for that elevated fire danger threat as well out there across the region. High temperatures will climb around 90 degrees in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-90s again for the Heber Valley. As we move into your Thursday, look for partly sunny skies out there. We're going to see a little bit of monsoon moisture trying to flirt with the area. So we will start to introduce a chance of a few isolated showers and thunderstorms across the region. We're not expecting a ton of rainfall, but there will be the chances of some of those isolated showers and storms starting to develop across parts of the area. That trend will continue into your Friday. In fact, I think Friday afternoon will be the best chance for a few of those isolated showers and storms to pop up in the afternoon. Park City will see high temperatures climbing into the low to mid 80s, with highs in the mid to upper 80s for the Heber Valley. The upcoming weekend forecast starts off with partly cloudy skies and a few isolated showers and storms in the afternoon. Highs will be in the low 80s in Park City, and we'll see those highs in the mid 80s for the Heber Valley. But as we move towards your Sunday, we're looking at drier air beginning to filter back into the area. So we'll call it sunshine with temperatures with highs in the low 80s again for Park City and highs in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. And then by the time we head into next week, we're going to be looking at that sunshine and high pressure rebuilding. So highs will be into the low to mid 80s for Park City with sunshine, and highs will be back near 90 degrees across the Heber Valley with lots of sunshine. So hopefully we can get a couple isolated showers between our Thursday and Saturday, because that's going to be the best chance. Otherwise, it's looking mainly dry and staying very summer-like for the rest of the week. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. From ABC4 Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott. We'll be taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. From the South Summit School District, Superintendent of Schools Greg Maughan calling in. He'll have details on last night's school board meeting, as well as the opening of this year's school year. And finally, from the Christian Center of Park City, I have Executive Director Steve Richardson, along with Program Director Eli Shackelford, with an update on their 25th anniversary celebration. Well, it is primary election day, and voters who still have their primary municipal election ballots must now turn them in at a local drop box or the county clerk's office by 8:00 tonight. A new law this year requires all ballots to be in a drop box or at the county clerk's office on the day of the election, not just postmarked by today's date. In Summit County, Colville, Hennifer, Francis, and Park City, residents are voting in the primary. 8 drop boxes are available around Summit County, including the county courthouse in Colville, the Park City Library, the Market at Park City, and Summit County Library branches in Colville and Camas. In-person voting and voter registration available today from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Colville City Hall, the Summit County Library Camas Branch, and Park City City Hall. In Wasatch County, Charleston, Heber, and Midway will all vote in primaries. Mail-in ballots can be dropped off in one of 4 drop boxes across Wasatch County, including Midway City offices and the Wasatch County Library. Residents can vote in person at the county building in Heber City from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Well, a freelance journalist sued for defamation by a former Park City School District executive officer wants a court to dismiss the lawsuit, stating her reporting is truthful and accurate. Court papers filed August 8th in 3rd District Court by attorneys for Michelle Deininger say her report on former chief operating officer for the Park City School District's Mike Tanner's job performance and remote work agreements with the district are a matter of great public concern protected under the First Amendment and Utah Constitution. Tanner sued the journalist in July, saying her November 19, 2024 story, published in the Park Record, contributed to the elimination of his position early this year and made it difficult for him to find another job. The story raised concerns about Tanner's compensation package and a remote work agreement. It alleged Tanner lived and worked part-time in Chicago during his tenure with the district. Tanner's attorney claimed it was based on false statements of fact, manipulated figures, and distorted half-truths that were patched together in a malicious attempt to damage Tanner's reputation and livelihood. In her response, Dininger denies the allegations and says statements in the lawsuit are an expression of pure opinion. She says she acted without malice and exercised the requisite degree of care and prudence in her reporting. At a minimum, to the extent Tanner suffered any reputational injury, such injury was caused by his own conduct, her attorneys wrote, not Dininger's constitutionally protected reporting. Dininger wants the court to dismiss the case with prejudice so that it can't be filed again. A request for comment sent via email to three attorneys who represent Tanner was not immediately returned yesterday. Dininger's report was published by the Park Record, but the newspaper wasn't named as a defendant in the lawsuit and declined to comment at this time. The Park City School District and the Utah Attorney General's Office launched investigations into the allegations after the story was published. None found criminal wrongdoing or school district policy violations. In June, the Utah Society of Professional Journalists honored Dininger with the Don Baker Investigative Journalism Award for her reporting, which she described on LinkedIn as a five-month deep dive into questionable spending and contracts within the Park City School District. Dininger was previously a KPCW employee between June 2021 and May 2023. The Summit County Council meets Wednesday morning starting at 10 a.m. to attend a tour with a housing strategy advisor. In the studio with details and a preview of the meeting, I have Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, so before we get to the agenda, let's talk a little bit about the Beulah Fire. What's Summit County's role in fighting this fire?
Well, it's a multi-agency response. We have the various departments from the county, the sheriff, the search and rescue, emergency manager, public works, communications, our different fire agencies. We were probably most beneficial to this particular fire as a first response. I think now there is a team, a federal team called the Great Basin Complex Incident team. I think they're involved in it now. It's at 3,351 acres. I think it's, last I heard, it's 0% contained.
Yeah, so are Summit County taxpayers on the line for paying the cost of fighting this fire?
Usually no. I think most of this fire is on federal land, besides the salaries and equipment and other items that we have lent to the effort. But besides that, no.
So when would the county be liable within unincorporated?
Yes, I mean, anytime we bring in resources, we're potentially on the hook. At the same time, most of the time, at least in the past, when we've used federal resources, we haven't had to pay for those resources. So it just does depend. If we do a good job of reporting, of submitting, receipts and things like that to FEMA, we often will have those things paid for us.
Okay. And I believe the county, self-insures itself against kind of catastrophes like this?
We do. I think we're a big enough organization where we do that, and we often do that in various ways with our different insurance policies.
Okay. And we didn't catch up with you after the approval of the Dakota Pacific development. You approved that based on the requirements of Senate Bill 26 with a change. So I wanted just to talk a little bit more about that. This change involved the phasing of the project with UDOT's Kimball Junction project. So can you explain what that change was and why it was needed?
Well, I don't know if it was needed. It was one of the final phases. And there was some discrepancy among that phase, whether UDOT would be, when they're 50% complete with the 224 fixes and the Kimball Junction interchange fixes, they're not going to then signal to us, okay, we're 50% done. That's not something they did. So we tried to tie it to months as opposed to 50% completion. And there was a discrepancy between the developer and most of my staff on how long that 50% would take. They said 5 months. I think we said 18 months. And I tried to just split that in half and put it at 9 months. There was maybe some consternation on the part of Dakota Pacific about that. But at the end of the day, I think once we get to that phase, I don't think they'll be sitting there mobilized waiting for this clock tick. I think there'll be various other delays or things that might take long that it won't make that much of a difference.
Yeah, I was going to say the sooner we can get 224 fixed, the better, no?
Absolutely, absolutely, and we believe that will, kick all this off. And I also like the idea of keeping the developer engaged in being unified in our discussions with UDOT and making sure that UDOT is doing this in a timely manner as well.
All right. What were you legally allowed to factor into your decision? I guess, what would it have taken for you to deny it?
Well, I think it was relatively up to the discretion probably of myself and legal. I did speak with our legal team about what substantially different meant when it came to this development agreement as opposed to what came forward with the council on December 18th of last year. You know, to me, it was very clear that it was very similar. I also think that when the legislature weighs in like that, they send a clear message of what they would like to see happen. And so I think any delay in that might just maybe make this a project worse. So the square footage that they were given as part of Senate Bill 26 was much more than was agreed to in December 18th of last year by the council and what they put forward in the development agreement. So things like that I think would have been increased and allowed by Senate Bill 26, and they would have asked for them. I think that would have been given me pause at least. I feel like that would have been different enough that we would have said no. But they, to their credit, they just asked for essentially what was agreed to last year by the county council.
Now, certainly members of the public asked you to consider the public opposition to the project. I mean, could you legally have factored that in your decision?
I don't believe I could have. I don't believe that was, I think once it was an administrative decision, it wasn't about how much we like the project or don't like the project. I believe it was about the application and whether they met the standard of Senate Bill 26. The legislative, if you will, decision was made by the Senate bill.
Yeah, and I guess what's your response to taxpayers here? I mean, we have a state-imposed development project that has no height limits, no setback requirements. So for those who have to live with this and pay taxes here, I mean, what do you tell them when they have no say in the future of their community?
Well, I don't think that they have no say. I mean, this is a project that was agreed to by the county council, and we elect our representatives to represent us, to vet this out completely. If someone would agree to sit with me for a time, I would also make a case why this particular development is meeting the standard of the Kimball Junction neighborhood plan that was adopted several years ago. I would also make a case why we need housing in this community, and if there is a place that would be appropriate for housing, it's the Kimball Junction neighborhood as far as the county goes. So I think that this can be a project, and if you listen to my remarks when I approved of that development agreement amendment, I said I believe, and I really do believe this still today, that there will be a time in the next couple of years before the Olympics when people walk around that area and look around and see restaurants and see a lively area and see a new location for the library and the Skullcandy building, and now you know there's the Kimball Arts is moving there. I think this is going to be a very exciting, active area for years to come before the Olympics and during the Olympics. We are already making plans to engage this area in a very exciting and fun way in the interim and leading up to the Olympics. So I think it's going to be the heart of the basin, if you will.
You've been in government a while, and I think there's folks wondering how we, the people, stop the state legislature from telling our community what we can and can't do when it comes to local control and planning.
Yeah. Well, it is an ongoing conversation, and I don't want to pivot too appropriately right to the housing tour we're having tomorrow morning with Mr. Weldrup, but he is what we call the housing czar for the state of Utah. He is the senior advisor for housing strategy for the governor's office. We are hopefully bringing him here to help him understand better what is going on in our community, and I think that effort is done in order to... hopefully his recommendations to the legislature will take that into account, that we are up here trying to do housing, that we have a lot of successes we'd like to talk about, that we have demographics that are specific, that where we need deed restrictions. I think the state of Utah is in this build baby build environment, and they believe that as we increase housing stock, we will drive the price down. That's not going to work in our community. We have to restrict housing if we're going to have affordable housing, and I think we are unique in a way enough, and credit to Mr. Waldrop and his staff for coming up here, and credit to Councilmember Armstrong, who pulled him aside at Rotary a couple of months ago and said, please come up to our community, see what's going on here, and take that into account when you make recommendations to the legislature.
So what's his role, this housing specialist role with the legislature?
Well, he's the senior advisor for housing strategy. So anything
for the state of Utah.
For the state of Utah. He was appointed by the governor. He's a former legislator himself. So I would say from a housing perspective, he's probably as powerful as it gets in the state of Utah. And recommendations coming from the governor's office will come through Mr. Waldrop and his staff. And we hope to really impress upon him the successes we've had and why our community wants that local control. It's the local control that takes into account the uniqueness of every city, county, local area, that we are different than Delta, Utah, we're different than Logan, Utah, and we're different from the Wasatch Front, and we want him to understand why that is. But at the same time, we've set a housing goal in our community. We aren't against housing, and my county council has agreed to 1,500 units in the next 10 years of deed-restricted affordable housing, in addition to Dakota Pacific, in addition to Klein Dolly, and we want to continue to make progress there. And as we do that, I believe that legislature will recognize that and leave that control in our hands.
Okay, well, here at Dakota Pacific certainly isn't the first time the legislature's been involved, and it likely is not the last. I mean, I guess, should we anticipate something like this happening in the 2026 state legislative session, now that the Colville City Council has voted not to annex a portion of that Cedar Crest property? Because, again, we're talking about property that was owned by two very powerful state legislators, Bell and Glenn Brown.
Sure. And I don't anticipate that will happen. I believe that we still have a lot of work to do there in Cedar Crest. If that may or may not go back to Colville City, that may come to the county as part of the unincorporated Hoytsville area. So I still believe there's a lot to do there that doesn't absolutely require something to be done in the 26th legislative session.
And wanted to ask you, I mean, the state law that we know allowed all of this was Senate Bill 26. The county sued the state regarding Senate Bill 84 2 years ago. Why not sue the state over Senate Bill 26 this time?
Well, I couldn't speak to the details of each of those bills, but even the lawsuit around SB 84 there was a very specific clause about the distance between, it was about part of the HTRZ, and it was a very specific part of that bill that allowed us to be victorious. At the end of the day, I believe that there's a recognition by us that the state of Utah makes the laws, the legislature makes the laws, and if we sue them because they did something unconstitutional or whatever it might be, they can go back the next session and change it. They can continue to make laws. We don't want to have an adversarial relationship with the legislature. We want to be collaborative. We want to work together. I think that some legislators would believe that SB 26 was them working together, was them working with us to codify what the county council said and what the developer wanted. Now, again, I've said this very clearly here, I've said it everywhere, I don't like when they take that control out of our hands. Let us be the one, and if we need to go through a process, a referendum process, let us play that out. That would be just fine with us. We want to see what happens there. At the end of the day, though, with a referendum, Leslie, if the county council could then come in after a referendum and redo that act. So at the end of the day, the council and our elected officials are the ones that make these decisions, and the legislature can do the same thing. When Proposition 2 with the medical marijuana passed, they changed that very much after what they heard the community and the state said, and they, you know, it's still the law of the land, but they watered it down and changed it as well. So at the end of the day, those folks are the ones that make the laws, and we need to be respectful of that. We don't want to just sue them every time we don't believe that they do what we like them to do. But I also don't believe we have very much legal standing to sue them on those things. And even if we win, they can come back and change those laws immediately after.
Okay, well, we should note that the Senate Bill 84 lawsuit is going to be dismissed now as a condition of all of this approval. Yeah, and what about that referendum effort? I mean, if in fact we get it put onto November's ballot and the public in fact votes against it, what happens? Does it even matter?
Well, I again, you're asking me. I'm not an attorney, but I don't believe it matters, and I don't believe it matters because I believe that the Senate Bill 26 track that is Dakota Pacific applying for an administrative development agreement is a separate track from the development agreement amendment that they requested from the county council last year. So that has been decided. That has a specific lane, if you will, and as we go forward with this Senate Bill 26 track, I believe, and I haven't spoken to Dakota Pacific, I don't know what they intend to do, but at some point they may pull the development agreement on that they submitted to the county council, and if they do so, that to me makes the referendum moot.
So with it approved, I mean, when's the earliest construction could start on Dakota Pacific?
I think it could start as soon as spring. I believe so.
Okay. Again, back to the agenda. Again, you've got a two-hour tour with this housing specialist. What do you hope comes out from this? I mean, is it just an informational meeting?
Yes. Well, for the most part, I think we would like to educate, Jeff Jones and Maddie McDonough from our housing department have put together a presentation where we talk about the specifics of our community with some of our accomplishments, our celebrator accomplishments, excuse me. But we also want to know from him and his staff. We've heard that the moderate income housing plan is going to change drastically, that it may not be something that is required of all of these local government organizations, that the state is going to take that over and adopt a plan that is forced upon us. We'd like to know about that. We've heard rumblings. So what can we get out of that? And it's also just a listening tour. We want to hear from him, from his staff about what they believe the future of housing is in our community. And then are there bills that are being proposed for the legislative session next year, and how and what are they, and what does that look like?
Later on, a discussion and possible adoption of the baseline and conservation easement for the 910 Cattle Ranch. Has the county closed on the property yet?
We haven't closed yet. We are hoping to close the very first of September. It's looking very positive to do so. We have the $40 million. The entire acquisition of this property is $55 million. We used $15 million of the 2021 voter approved open space bond towards that, and then the other 40 is coming from a Forest Legacy Fund grant, which is secure, and we're hoping to close in September. This is an important step in that, to create the baseline and the conservation easement, and have county Council Chair Tanya Hansen signed that, as well as myself.
Okay, so does this conservation easement baseline have to be done before you can close, or it's not requisite?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's really requisite for closing, but we're trying to do all this together. It's definitely requisite. The baseline is requisite before we have a conservation easement, and the conservation easement is obviously very important to this process. We need to memorialize the values that we have on that property, and that's and whether it's required to close, I'm not sure, but we're trying to do all this in line and put it together for the first of September.
Okay, and I know that the council's meeting in closed session regarding property acquisition. I mean, is it something new, or is it something you've been discussing already?
Something we've been discussing already, but I will tell you it's not related to the 910.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
I don't think so. Felt like I said a lot today. Thank you for your efforts, and I hope we're all having a wonderful summer. We had a wonderful fair. The fair went off without a hitch, and it's just a wealth of opportunities for us to have things to do all summer, so it's really a blessing.
Okay. Summit County Manager Shane Scott, thanks for your
time.
Thanks
for having me, Leslie.
South Summit Board of Education met last night, and on the phone with a meeting recap, I have South Summit School District Superintendent Greg Vaughn. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Leslie?
Doing well, thank you. So let's just start with back to school first. When do students head back to school?
Well, our Silver Summit School over in the Silver Creek area, they actually start this week, and Camas Valley schools start next week.
Okay. All different days, or?
So Silver Summit School, they start this Wednesday, and okay. Camas Valley starts next Wednesday. It for a lot of people, it seems odd that a district would have some schools starting on different days, but based on the individual need of the local communities of those schools, our board has allowed that to happen for several years. So it does seem a little odd, but at the same time, That doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It really just means we're trying to meet the needs of those who will be attending those schools.
All right. I know the official enrollment numbers don't have to be reported until October 1st, but give me an estimate. How many students do you have enrolled?
Well, so enrollment is still going on right now, and we're still seeing students, parents enrolling students. They were doing that yesterday. They'll continue to do it probably all week, and it's not uncommon for that to happen for the first week or two of school. Right now, total-wise, we're sitting right around 1,535, right in there, which... I think we seem to be on track with where we generally would be as we get this last push of families enrolling, coming back from their vacations and that. So we're anticipating that our enrollment will probably be somewhere similar to what it has been last year.
Yeah, all right. So how does this compare with your budget projections? And you're in the clear here.
Yeah, we our business administrator, he's fantastic, and he's pretty fiscally conservative, and which I love. I appreciate that not only as a superintendent, but I appreciate that as a taxpayer. We're not one of the districts that we're doing truth and taxation this year. We are not doing that. And anyway, he's got a really great handle on our budgets, and And so we should be in the clear and certainly in the black. And of course, I don't want to jinx it for anything because the year is just getting ready to start. But yeah, things overall seem to be right about where we would hope they would be.
Okay. And certainly this was before your time, but I mean, we were talking about just growth and more growth. And so what happened to all the growth the district was planning for? It doesn't sound like it's materialized.
Well, I can tell you, yeah, that was before my time, but I can tell you it has not materialized. But I think there are any number of reasons that could be, but COVID could have been part of it. But I wouldn't want to put a whole lot of stock in that. To me, I think a lot of what has happened is the cost of housing has just gone up so quickly and so much that a lot of families struggle to be able to move to, to our area, our district, and not just our district, but, everywhere in Summit County for that. And I think that probably plays a large part in it. We certainly, we talk about that as we're recruiting and hiring people, the cost of housing and things So I would venture to guess that played a pretty large part in it. We are seeing some growth. There's quite a bit of building in Francis right now, and we'll hopefully see an increase in student enrollment coming from that new growth. And we have seen there are quite a few families that have decided to re-enroll their students after homeschooling them or sending them to a charter or private school. So we have seen an uptick in students coming back for this year, which is exciting. We're happy for that. But yeah, I mean, off the projections, I think they projected we would have been a couple hundred to a few hundred more than what we are.
Yeah, I think the district's already gone through some sort of master planning effort. So that is ready to go. And if in fact you do start to see some numbers go up?
Yeah, you hope for the best, plan for the worst, and it generally falls somewhere in between there. We're hoping to see some increased enrollment, not just in Francis area, but in the Silver Creek area, and we're hoping to see some in across the Camas Valley, not just in Francis. But Francis is where there's been a lot of building.
Okay, let's see. Anything else back to school related that the community should know about?
Well, I can tell you it's always fun every year to go into a school right about now. There's just a different kind of buzz happening. You see a lot of the teachers back already, just excited, working on their classrooms, getting them just perfect, so that when students walk in day one, they walk into just something wonderful, and so it's a different vibe in a school right now. It's a lot of fun to see the preparation. Teachers are working their tails off to be prepared. Our administrators are working hard to be prepared. Our custodians have rocked it. They've knocked it out of the park. They've been working their tails off all summer to have these buildings ready, projects finished, and things like that, so that kids walk into buildings that are conducive to learning and happiness. And so we're really excited to get going with the year.
All right. And do you still have some mobile classrooms that you're using?
Don't know that I'd say mobile, but we don't have the traditional portables that you see at schools. Our high school does have, we call it a relocatable. It's several of those that have been kind of combined into its own wing of the school, if you will. But that's really the only one that we have.
Okay, at the high school. All right. Has the district made any changes to its cell phone policy to come in compliance with the new law?
Yeah. So the new law requires, no cell phone use during classes. It does give some leeway to local school boards to decide if they don't want a cell phone policy. Our board did not go that route. Our new cell phone policy, in fact, we had our first reading last night. If you read the policy and the procedure, it really just kind of follows along and aligns directly with state board rules, state code, and model policy around cell phones. And so it addresses the use of cell phones and other personal electronic devices during class time, and prohibits prohibits those. There's obviously some exceptions to that. We do have some students that monitor like their blood sugar, for example, and they're going to have to be able to continue to do so. And that's all done on a case by case basis. But across the board, cell phones are prohibited from being out and being used in class.
All right. Also on last night's agenda, the board was scheduled to review the vision and mission statements. Are these new or just being reflected upon as this, at the start of school?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Thank you. So we start every board meeting with the pledge, and then we also go through our mission and vision. I love that we start our meetings that way, because it's just a regrounding of really why we're there in that meeting. That everything should have a through line to student impact and efficient and effective running of schools. So we do that every meeting, we just alternate through who does that, and it's a great way to start.
All right. The school board also heard from Athletic Director Brian Jaquetta discussing Title IX. What was that discussion about?
Yeah. So there's in state code, schools that have competing programs, so generally it's high schools only, they have to report to the board every year before school starts certain pieces of information. So last night, Coach Jaquetta, who he's a new employee, and we're so excited to have him. He did a great job. Talk about baptism by fire. School hasn't even started, and you're reporting to the board. So last night he reported to the board on just on our extracurricular activities, such as like participation numbers by male, female, and co-ed opportunities, things like that. The spending, it's really to make sure that we don't get out of alignment and favor one, not just one sport, but opportunities for one, for males, or opportunities for females. It's really just a check and balance to make sure we're being fair and equitable in facilities, in finance, and in opportunities.
And are you?
We are. We fall well under the 10. There's a 10%. They give you a 10% leeway, and we're at 5%. So we're doing well, better than many. And I attribute that to great administrators, great coaches, great athletic directors, and really taking a look at making sure they're doing what's best for all students that are participating.
All right. The school board also welcomed more than 20 new hires. Is that about normal? It seems like a lot.
Well, it's funny. We had new employee orientation last week, and it actually was a smaller group. The 20, that includes all of our paraprofessionals, and that's all hires. And so it's pretty common for schools to have high numbers when you're bringing all of those new hires in, whether it's a 5-hour per week person or a full-time teacher. As far as teachers go, we've hired 5 teachers for this year, which is, I think, our smallest number that we've had that I know of, which is exciting because we not only want to recruit the best, but we want to retain the best. And so we've seen that we're losing fewer and we're able to keep those people. So I think it's a good place to be in.
All right. How challenging is it to staff the school district these days?
Well, you know, being in South Summit, and I think North Summit would have a similar issue, is a lot of people, if they don't live here in the Valley, you know, in your district boundary, you're having to ask people to drive through at least one, if not 2 or 3 other school districts to get to your district. So that is a little bit of a complexity or a nuance to the Eastern Summit County districts. But we've our board a couple of years ago, you know, with the first strategic plan and having a goal to be in the top 10% with pay, really helped retain people and really helped in our recruiting efforts. And so knock on wood, but our hiring's actually been really good the last couple of years.
All right. Finally, I wanted to ask you about the SHINE program. This is, my understanding, a district-wide mentoring program?
It is. It's a new program that, Miss Lucinda Josie and Teresa Lim, our HR director and one of our teacher leaders, have developed this district-wide mentor program. There are some requirements around, you know, from the state, for mentors, for new teachers and that. And traditionally, it was always just done at each school and was not as consistent as what we'd like. And you know, we talk about recruiting and retention. One of the things that's really important is that people feel supported when they get here. And so it's exciting to one of my favorite parts of the SHINE program is that we're really helping to build our teachers' capacity, not just the mentor, but also the mentee. And so we're excited to see how that goes this year. We've got some really great plans for not just rolling that out, but just keeping it going all year. One thing that is a little more unique for us is that we're not limiting it to just new teachers. We actually have some teachers that have changed some assignments. And so they're going to be faced with something a little different than what they are used to. And so they wanted an opportunity to have a mentor. And so we're really taking a strong effort to support all of our teachers, whether they're new or whether they have a new assignment that's quite different from their previous one, things like that. And so we're excited to have it. Those two ladies have just worked. They've worked the end of last year and all summer to bring this support to our teachers. And I couldn't be more excited to see how it goes.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Greg?
Boy, I've had a lot to say. We're doing well. We're excited to get the school year started. This is the time of year where now you just think, okay, let's just get the kids here. Let's just do it. Let's stop talking about it. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, have a great school year. Thanks for your time.
Talk to you later.
That's Superintendent of South Summit School District, Greg Mon. In the studio now with an update from the Christian Center of Park City, I have Executive Director Steve Richardson along with a new Program Director, Eli Shackelford. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eli, let's start with you. You were brought on just a couple of months ago?
Yes, I've been here 3 months.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why this was something, a job that you were interested in.
I retired from pastoring. I use the word retired lightly because it's a lot of what I'm still doing, just caring for people. I love the Christian Center's heart for people. And I tell everybody, I love people. People are my passion. So seeing this opening just felt like a perfect fit. We've been in the Valley for about 12, 13 years. Saw it and hopped on it. It's been great.
Okay. So what's kept you busy the last couple of months then?
I came on board right as we were starting a project. Well, we should have been starting it probably earlier, but felt like the beginning of the project for me. We just did back to school basics, where we outfit local kids from Summit and Wasatch with backpacks, some school supplies, and then a gift card to shop at the outlets.
Okay, how'd that go?
It was amazing. It was last week. I could not believe the number of people that come through. We were shooting for about 1,500 kids, but then I just didn't think about the grandparents, the babies. So we had thousands of kids come through the outlets, and the line was backed up all the way down the street. Just very fun, real high energy. Families were super grateful. Kids were fun and had a good time.
Okay, so you met the goal in terms of outfitting everyone that had wanted to be outfitted?
I believe so. Yep, we were a little short on the financial goal, but I'm sure we'll figure that out as time goes along.
Okay, and then what else do you have on your plate going forward here?
The next thing coming up is Hike for Hunger, which is this. We've done that for years in Park City here. This year is a little bit different. It's our 25th anniversary celebration. So we are going all out and just throwing a huge party to thank our volunteers, to kind of bring our clientele and our donors and our volunteers all together, staff, just everybody that's part of the Christian Center. We are hoping will show up on that day. It's at the Utah Olympic Park, and it's going to be a fun and just very filled day.
Okay, so Steve, I don't know, you weren't here for last year's, or were you?
I was and I wasn't.
Yeah.
So I wasn't working yet. I started October 1st, but I attended. My wife and I were in between the military and coming here, so we wanted to see what it was like, and we're just trying to take what we saw last year and triple to quadruple it.
Oh, yep. Okay. So is that happening? I mean,
It looks like it. The activities we have, the food we have coming, the band, everything is just taking last year and saying, okay, how could we make it the absolute best that we could do? So the best food, we rented out the entire Utah Olympic Park, so all the activities are going to be free. The band we have is Hot House West, which is actually the PhD band director of BYU and Weber and University of Utah. All of these PhDs are saying, how can we make the best band possible for a swing band? And so they formed the band. They're the ones that are actually going to play for us. It's phenomenal. And so everything is just as good as you could possibly imagine, just because we want to honor the community and we really want to highlight the needs the community have, get donors together with volunteers, together with especially our clientele, and create some community.
All right, so it's happening September 6th.
It is.
What are the hours?
September 6th.
2 to 6.
2 to 6, okay. Yep. And tickets are how much?
So it's a $15 donation. We'd love for as much as we can, and we're trying to make it as small as possible just so we can get as many people there. So if somebody can't afford $15, we're good with that too.
Okay, and you said lots of food. Is that additional
feed? It is not.
No?
Everything's included.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
You could see a crowd.
Yeah. Oh, I hope so.
Uh-huh. 25 years, I guess that's crazy to think that it's been that long already. Can you talk about some of the accomplishments of the center over that last 2.5 decades?
I've had the chance to talk to people who have been around from the very beginning, and it all is one-on-one. Hey, we saw this homeless person, and now this person has a job and has a house. Or we saw somebody who was completely in need from Peace House who brought him over, and we were able to get him clothing, and we were able to get him food. And just that partnership in the community. One of my favorite experiences was actually the first month I was here, second month in November. One of the local establishments, local stores, had sponsored a 5K race, and the entrance fee was to bring two cans of food to the food pantry. And so I was talking to the two workers and saying how much it meant to get this food and how much of a need there was in the community, and they both started to laugh at me. And the reason they laughed at me, they explained, was because they both used to be customers of the food pantry, and that's why they were volunteering to put this on, that they no longer needed it and they wanted to help others. And we've heard so many stories of that over the last 25 years, of somebody who needed services and then wanted to come back and wanted to volunteer because they know other people do. And so we love the idea of being able to take people when they're really at their most needy, help them to live that better life so that they don't need us anymore, but want to use us to give back to somebody else.
Okay, well, the event is Hike for Hunger, and I know you're kind of putting it under the umbrella of the anniversary.
Yes.
But how is it going to benefit your food pantry program?
So the biggest thing we're hoping is just to let people know that there are still hungry people in Summit County and Wasatch County. So often we drive around and we see the huge houses, we see the great establishments, they're all wonderful, it's so beautiful here, and to forget that there are workers who really need help. So the biggest thing we're hoping is awareness. We're hoping people see what we're doing and decide we want to donate afterwards. If nobody donates afterwards, yeah, we did not do well financially on this one because we're going to lose lots and lots of money. But we're hoping that we're going to have people that for the next 15, 20, 25 years say, I really want to donate to make sure that people have a healthy meal and a healthy food.
Okay, so with all of the other activities to do at the UOP, are you still going to do the hikes?
We are. There's not as many hikes, but there are still hikes. We'll still have hiking, but we're hoping as many people can sit and enjoy the band, enjoy the food, and then hear some of the stories of what the impact is throughout our community.
Okay, Eli, how do people register? Because I think you do want to know numbers.
Yeah, you can hop online, go onto our website, register there is probably the best way if you're not on our email list. We do send out regular emails, so if you'd like to be part of that, same thing, hop online, go on our page, just sign up for that.
So just Google Christian Center of Park City.
Yep.
Or any other search engine.
Okay. Hey, anything else you guys want to mention?
I just want to say that for the Back to School Basics, it was so touching when I walked into Back to School Basics and I saw a little six-year-old boy showing off a new pair of shoes. And the way he was describing it is it was his first ever new pair of shoes. And he was so proud. He had walked back into the Back to School Basics area after shopping and wanted to show everybody his new pair of shoes. To see that kind of dignity, that kind of value, and that kind of respect is why we do this.
Yeah.
So I'm just so thankful.
That's really what we're going for.
Okay. Yeah. Steve, Eli, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you,
Leslie. Thank you.
Park City will break ground on nearly a $20 million new community center in City Park on Thursday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on that.
The new City Park building will replace the small brick structure adjacent to the sand volleyball and basketball courts that was built in the 1980s. Park City Recreation Director Ken Fisher said the new 15,000-square-foot community center will create more space for a variety of programming.
There'll be opportunities for the community to rent space to use for meetings or different events. There's a great community room that has a big patio that will open out to the park.
The new building will allow Park City to increase summer camp capacity by more than 50 children. Fisher said they will also relocate some recreation programs from the Mark to the new building. Starting August 18th, the volleyball and basketball courts will be closed for construction, along with the playground and existing City Park building with bathrooms. Fisher said both courts and the playground will be upgraded.
Nice thing about the volleyball courts, they currently sort of sit east-west, which isn't the best layout for a court because of the sun. The new courts will run north and south, so that will really enhance the the volleyball playing experience. You won't have to battle the sun.
Construction is estimated to be complete by December 2026. Fisher said he's grateful of the support the mayor and city council gave to the project.
I really believe this project shows their commitment to the residents.
The Park City Council and the city's planning commission previously approved plans for the project. It's being paid for with money from the capital budget and funds from a 2019 sales tax revenue bond that is tied directly to an additional tax increment on properties in the Lower Park Avenue area. Residents are invited to the groundbreaking ceremony for the community center Thursday, August 14th at 1 p.m. next to the basketball and volleyball courts. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.